Calling all podcast fans. Spotify makes it easier than ever to discover new shows to love. Get personalized episode recommendations and easily preview them before you dive right in. Find exclusive video episodes from your favorite hosts and guests. And with some, you can even connect with them through polls and Q&A directly within their episodes. It's everything you want in one app. So what are you waiting for? Try the podcast experience today on Spotify.
This episode is brought to you by Soylent, the nutritionally complete, ready-to-drink meal in a bottle. Introducing Coffeeist, a balanced breakfast blended with lightly roasted coffee and a hint of chocolate flavor. It's an energizing morning meal, too convenient to skip. It's quite simply the most convenient, affordable breakfast. And Soylent is doing good in the world. For every case of Coffeeist purchased, a meal is donated to those in need through World Food Program USA. Learn more at soylent.com/murders. And now part three of The Phantom Killer. And just a reminder, some kids under the age of 13 might find bits of our show a little bit scary, so parental guidance is suggested. Enjoy the show.
Virgil. Virgil, what was that? Did you drop something?
Oh my God, Virgil, are you all right? Virgil! Oh my Lord. I gotta call the police.
Oh. I know you're in there. Come on out.
No.
You'll never get away.
Go. Don't stop. No. Help! Not home. Help! Help.
Katie, what the?
Virgil's dead. Oh.
Welcome to Unsolved Murders, True Crime Stories. I'm Carter Roy.
And I'm Wendy McKenzie.
Today, we're continuing our investigation into the sensational case of the Phantom Killer.
A serial murderer terrorizing Texarkana.
So far, there have been three separate attacks, and four are dead.
Law enforcement is puzzled by a mysterious man who has been targeting couples on Lover's Lane.
I'm gonna kill you.
And right now, they have no suspects.
This killer is the luckiest person I have ever known. No one sees him, hears him in time, or can identify him in any way.
If the sheriff, with all of his resources at his disposal, can't catch him, maybe he really is a phantom.
So folks are spending restless nights with guns beside the bed.
Waiting.
Hoping the danger has passed.
Fearing there's more to come.
This is episode 8 of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Stories, and episode 3 of the Phantom Killer case. If you want to review an episode of Unsolved Murders or to hear our investigation into other cases, you can find them all on your favorite podcast directory. Don't forget to subscribe. You can also listen on our website, parcast.com, spelled P-A-R-C-A-S-T.com. A new episode comes out every other Tuesday. Visit our Facebook page, Parcast, to join the conversation. And now, back to the Phantom Killer.
It's May of 1946, and Texarkana is a town in turmoil.
The trouble started back in February, when Jimmy Hollis and Mary Jean Larry stopped on a side road at the end of their date Friday night.
Are you gonna kiss me, Jimmy?
I just might, Mary Jean.
Only to encounter a masked man with a flashlight.
Hey, what's going on? You're blinding me. Now, fella, you've got me mixed up with someone else. You've got the wrong man.
Unfortunately for Jimmy, he was the man the stranger wanted to target that night. And he ended up in the hospital with three skull fractures.
And poor Mary Jean.
Poor Mary Jean ended up being assaulted and terrorized to the point where she thought she would be better off dead.
Go ahead and kill me!
Fortunately, Jimmy and Mary Jean survived.
But the next couple, were not so lucky.
It happened 1 month later, in March. Richard Griffin and Pollyann Moore.
Another pair out on a date.
Stopped on a lover's lane on Rich Road.
Are you going to tell me you ran out of gas?
You're too smart to fall for that.
They were found the next morning.
Sunday morning.
Richard had been shot twice and Polly once, both fatally.
The suspect was now leaving a trail of dead bodies.
In April, he struck again.
Wow, Betty Jo. When I hear you play, it's like music from heaven.
Come on, Paul. It's no big deal. It's just practice is all.
And it was the cruelest attack yet. After a dance at the VFW hall, 15-year-old Betty Jo Booker and the boy who was giving her a ride home, Paul Martin, never arrived at their destination.
Have you seen Betty Jo Booker? She was supposed to be at a slumber party and never showed.
There was a frantic search with a tragic outcome.
Paul's body was found in Spring Lake Park. He had been shot 4 times.
And later on, a volunteer searcher from a church group made the gruesome discovery of Betty Jo's corpse.
Oh my God, there she is. Oh my God, there she is. Oh my God, there she is!
It was another awful Sunday morning. 2 more victims.
Teenagers, no less, with their whole lives before them.
And not only was Texarkana in mourning, but they were terrified of the killer in their midst.
You hear about things like this in the big city, but in our town?
Who is safe anymore?
No one with this maniac out there.
I tell you what, I'm not driving anywhere after dark.
Still, despite the fear and the grief, the town also started to pull together. First at Betty Jo's funeral.
Mrs. Booker, my condolences on your loss.
Where Texas High School let out at noon so hundreds of young people could attend.
Then, with the reward that had been announced on the Monday after Paul and Betty Jo's death.
Today, Sheriff Presley and Chief Runnels offered a reward of $500 for solution-breaking information in the Betty Jo Booker-Paul Martin case. This is being augmented by $100 from concerned citizen Oliver Dreyer, so the total is $600. If you wish to make a contribution, please contact station KCMC.
Which had grown over tenfold in just 10 days.
We have an update on the reward in the Phantom Killer case. As of this morning, the reward is up to $6,425.
And keep in mind, $6,425 in 1946 would be worth over $83,000 today.
The media were now calling these incidents the Texarkana Moonlight Murders.
And many were under the mistaken impression that they all took place under a full moon.
They didn't, but they still happened once a month.
And the last 2 attacks had happened exactly 3 weeks apart.
Which means there was good reason for the entire town to be nervous.
Because the next 3-week cycle was up.
Virgil Starks was a 37-year-old farmer and welder who lived on a 500-acre farm 10 miles northeast of Texarkana.
Katie, that pie was good enough to win a prize at the fair.
His wife of 14 years, Katie, was 36. They had gone to school together and known each other most of their lives.
Oh, Virgil, you say that every time.
It's true, it's true.
It was the night of May 3rd, 1946.
I'm going to get ready for bed.
I'm going to sit here a while and listen to my program.
Oh, let me get you the heating pad for your back.
Thank you. That feels great.
Katie went to the bedroom, and a short time later thought she heard something in the backyard.
Virgil, did you hear that? Could you turn the radio down?
Within seconds, Virgil, sitting in his easy chair reading the newspaper, was shot twice through the double-pane window facing the sitting room. At first, Katie thought it was just breaking glass.
Virgil, what was that? Did you drop something?
She saw Virgil slumped in the chair.
Oh my God, Virgil, are you all right? Virgil!
And realized he had been shot.
Oh my Lord!
She went to call police on the crank phone. When she herself was shot twice. One bullet entered her right cheek and exited behind her left ear. The other entered her jaw and split her lip, breaking several teeth before lodging under her tongue.
But miraculously, Katie was still alive.
Thus began a desperate struggle to get away.
Later, a deputy observing the scene would say,
"It was a virtual river of blood and teeth through the house.
I know you're in there.
The killer tore loose the rusted screen wire on the back porch, made his way to the back of the house, and broke the screen door. Then Katie heard him coming in through the kitchen window.
Come on out.
No.
Still clad in her blood-soaked nightgown, she made a break for it. Katie ran barefoot to her sister and brother-in-law's house across the street.
Help!
But they weren't home.
Not home.
So she ran on 50 yards more to the house of a neighbor, A.V. Prater.
Help! Help.
Katie, what the?
Virgil's dead. Oh.
And after delivering that news, she collapsed. Prater shot a rifle in the air to summon a neighbor, Elmer Taylor. Taylor drove Katie Starks to the hospital. She was still semi-conscious, but slumped in the front seat.
Here, take this.
She gave Taylor one of her gold fillings. At the hospital, Katie Starks went right into the operating room.
Code blue.
Where's the bullet?
Gunshot wound to the face. She's losing a lot of blood.
Despite the grisly injury, Katie never went into shock and her heart rate remained steady.
After the doctors had done their work, it was clear she would live.
For the first time since Jimmy Hollis and Mary Jean Larry back in February, someone had survived an encounter with the Phantom Killer.
We'll return to our story in just a moment.
And now, back to the story. After the attack on Virgil and Katie Starks on Friday, May 3rd, the authorities descended on the Starks farmhouse. And there were contradictory reports from the scene. One deputy said they found Virgil Starks still slumped in the chair while smoke came out around him where the heating pad had set his corpse on fire. Other officers said that Starks' body had fallen to the floor, so it wasn't burned when the chair caught on fire.
Does it matter?
No, I don't think it does. What is more relevant is that the farm abuts Highway 67 East, and the officers quickly established roadblocks in the surrounding area to catch and stop the perpetrator. Officers were called in from the entire area to help the investigation.
Including the FBI, the Texas Rangers, county sheriffs, the state police, and local law enforcement.
Unfortunately, the all-out dragnet did not work.
Once again, the Phantom had gotten away.
And the headlines the next day...
Murder Rock City again! Farmer slain, wife wounded!
Only served to heighten the town's anxiety.
Assassin's bullets kill Virgil Starks!
But was this attack the work of the Phantom Killer?
An excellent question.
Because this was different than previous crimes. It was an older couple living at home, not a couple in a car on Lover's Lane.
Also, it happened 10 miles northeast of Texarkana, in a more rural area.
And the murder weapon was a .22 automatic rifle, and not a .32 caliber pistol.
Still, it's possible the killer had moved to a more remote area because there was opportunity there.
Which dovetails with our earlier speculation that this serial killer would be categorized as disorganized, killing when he had the chance rather than meticulous planning.
Also, he was keeping to the general MO of attacking couples, after dark on a weekend, and doing it 3 weeks apart.
Which may be why Miller County Sheriff W.E. Davis said,
"It's possible that the killer and the Phantom are the same man."
One of the people who thought it was the same attacker was one of the first victims, Jimmy Hollis.
"I think there are three people alive today who escaped from that man. The woman who's in the hospital now, Katie Starks, Mrs. Larry, and me."
Another person who believed all the attacks were from one perpetrator was Dr. Anthony LaPaula.
And who is that?
Dr. LaPaula was a psychologist working at the Federal Correctional Institute in Texarkana.
"Thanks for agreeing to this interview, Dr. LaPaula."
"I'm doing this only in the interest of informing the public. I don't want to alarm anyone, but just to give my insight on mental behavior."
He spoke with the Texarkana Gazette in early May.
"I believe the same man is responsible for the murders of Virgil Starks, Betty Joe Booker, Paul Martin, Richard Griffin, and Pollyann Moore. We're looking for a man in his mid-30s to early 50s.
"And what motivates him?"
"He's evidently a sadist and motivated by a strong sex drive. A person who would commit these crimes is intelligent, shrewd, clever, and often not apprehended."
"What's next?"
"He's been following the investigation and knows that certain roads are being watched. He has been driven to the outskirts of town and is likely to make more attacks, like the one on Virgil Starks."
The doctor seems pretty convinced that this is all the work of one killer.
He was. But regardless, the police were investigating every theory and pursuing every lead.
And this time they had a witness, because despite the wounds to Katie Starks, she was still alive.
What happened next, Mrs. Starks?
There were two shots through the window, and I was knocked to my knees.
Did you get a look at the killer?
No, I didn't see him. I heard him coming in through the window, and I just ran.
There was also a clue found at the Starks' home.
The fingerprints of the killer?
No, that would be too easy.
Sheriff, over here, in the bushes.
They found a flashlight outside the house. They posted a picture of the flashlight in the paper, the first color photograph ever run in the Gazette.
Extra, have you seen this two-cell flashlight?
Unfortunately, despite their best efforts, they could not tie it to a suspect.
Well, it is only a flashlight.
True, and nobody recognized it, so it was another dead end. But the pressure was growing on the police, because in the wake of the Starks attack, the hysteria in Texarkana reached its apex.
There was a run on locks, guns, and ammunition.
Sorry, sold my last box of shells just 10 minutes ago.
Folks stocked up on window shades, night latches, and screen door hooks.
Give me the Venetian blinds. I don't need no killer peeping in my house.
Residents who had never owned guns slept with loaded pistols on both sides of the bed and made pallets on the floor so their children could sleep beside them.
Hush now and go to sleep. Mama is here to protect you.
Liquor stores closed at 9:30 and refused to sell to anyone who had already been drinking.
Cleet, you best go home. We don't need drinkers out clogging up the streets when the sheriff needs to do his work.
People even tied together pots and pans in a Rube Goldberg-like way to warn them if somebody was approaching.
And part of the panic was fueled by Captain Gonzalez of the Texas Rangers.
Captain Gonzalez, what would you tell the citizens of Texarkana?
Oil up their guns and see if they are loaded. Put them out of reach of the children. Do not use them unless it's necessary. But if you believe it is, do not hesitate.
Exactly who was this Captain Gonzalez?
J.Q. Mahaffey, Texarkana Gazette editor during the spree of the Phantom, described Gonzalez, who had the nickname Lone Wolf.
He was one of the best-looking men I've ever seen and wore a spotless khaki suit and a white 10-gallon hat. He packed two ivory-handled revolvers on his hips and did not deny that he was the ranger who sat in the cashier's office in the Crazy Water Hotel in Mineral Wells and gunned down two ex-convicts who sought to rob the place. He was so good-looking that my girl reporters would not leave him alone.
What's the latest, Captain?
Please, call me Lone Wolf.
He really didn't have time to hunt down the Phantom. He was too busy giving out interviews and trying to run the Gazette. All of the other officers working on the case were intensely jealous of Lone Wolf and complained bitterly every time his picture appeared in the paper.
Maybe I should have met this Lone Wolf.
Oh, no, not you too. For all his success with the ladies, he was coming up a big fat zero in the investigation.
There was still a killer loose.
And no one knew where he'd strike next. Although most of the town was in fear of the Phantom.
Closing up early again, Sal?
No use staying open. Everyone's locked away at home.
Some teenagers continued parking on Lover's Lanes. A few of them hoped to play hero and catch the elusive slayer. One night, Officer Tillman Johnson was patrolling a lonely road with Arkansas State Trooper Charlie Boyd when they came up to a parked car.
Let me check it out.
Johnson got out while Boyd stayed behind. Johnson walked up to the car and noticed a couple.
I am Tillman Johnson with the Miller County Sheriff's Department. Aren't you scared to be parked out here at night?
You're the one that ought to be scared, mister. It's a good thing you told me who you are. I've had my 25 pointing at you the whole time.
And that wasn't the only incident. There was the call to the Arkansas police station not long after the murder of Virgil Starks.
What's your emergency?
I live by the Starks farmhouse, and I swear I just saw some strange lights there.
The officers raced to the scene.
We know you're in there. We have the place surrounded. You might as well give up.
Put those guns down.
A figure came into view.
The Phantom?
Stand down. It's just me.
Nope. Lone Wolf Gonzalez.
Captain, what are you doing here?
With a female photographer from Life magazine.
I was just showing her the crime scene so she could take some pictures.
Yeah, he was just showing her the crime scene.
all of which led Trooper Tackett to loudly complain.
You can quote me as saying that the Phantom murders will never be solved until Texarkana gets rid of the big city press and the Texas Rangers.
It was a boast that would prove strangely prescient, because before long, Max Tackett himself was about to make a break in the case. Texarkana was still jittery, and only got more so as it approached 3 weeks from the Starks' murder.
I can't take it anymore. Yesterday I was on the street and I heard a car backfire. Nearly soiled my britches.
And rumors flew.
I heard they caught the Phantom. It's the minister's son. They've got a squad of Texas Rangers armed with submachine guns holding them at the jail.
But there was no suspect in custody and no further attacks from the Phantom.
Maybe it was all that law enforcement in the area.
Could be.
Or maybe the Phantom had moved on to another unsuspecting location.
Also possible. Then 3 weeks became a month. And a month became 6 weeks. And with each passing day, the town eased up a little. At some point, Captain Gonzalez...
Ah, the lone wolf.
...who had vowed to stay in Texarkana until the killer was caught, quietly slipped out of town.
Did he take the photographer from Life magazine with him?
You've turned on the lone wolf. But the investigation went on.
Tillman, have you noticed that whenever there's an attack, a car gets stolen?
Max Tackett, then a 31-year-old Arkansas state trooper, realized he might be able to get a lead on the Phantom by tracking down stolen vehicles.
If we find the man who stole this 41 Plymouth sedan the night of the Griffin Moore murders, he'd be a person of interest.
On Friday, June 28th, his partner found that very car in a parking lot. So they staked it out and caught a woman trying to claim it.
Don't move! You're under arrest!
When they brought her in for questioning...
My name is Peggy Swinney.
You know that car you were in is stolen?
I thought it was my husband's. We just got married yesterday down in Shreveport.
Max realized the man he wanted was her husband of one day, UL Swinney.
And they said it wouldn't last.
Do you know where your husband is?
No, but he likes to go to the movies in the afternoon.
One day, a couple weeks later, Tackett received a report of a mysterious stranger trying to sell a car to a local auto dealership. The dealer suspected the car was stolen.
I think this is our man.
There was a witness with a distinctive look who had been present when Swinney tried to sell the hot car.
You wouldn't recognize the man, but he would recognize you.
Could be.
Here's what we're gonna do. We're going to walk into some public places and I'll watch to see if anyone reacts to seeing you. He won't want to stick around in case you recognize him, and when he makes a break for it, we'll get him.
That seems like quite a stretch.
Maybe, but it worked. The distinctive man walked into the Atlanta, Texas bus station, and a suspect ran, with Trooper Tackett in close pursuit. The suspect was eventually cornered on the fire escape.
Put your hands up!
Please don't shoot me.
I'm not gonna shoot you for stealing cars.
Mister, don't play games with me. You want me for more than stealing cars.
So, it certainly sounds like he thought he was caught for a serious crime.
Later, he displayed the same attitude in the squad car.
Mr. Johnson, what do you think they'll do to me for this? Will they give me the chair?
You won't get much. Maybe 5 or 10 years. They don't give you the electric chair for stealing cars.
Mr. Johnson, you got me for more than stealing cars.
So Swinney himself seemed to think he was being captured for a major crime. And then, after repeated questioning, his wife began to make her statements about the night of the Booker Martin murders.
He told me that he was going out to the park and robbed someone. Swinney told the couple that if they did not hand over everything they had, that he would kill them. Swinney had the gun pointed at the boy. He shot him 2 times and the boy fell to the ground. The little girl and I began to scream. Swinney told me that he tried to get some from the little girl and she would not let him have it and that he killed her.
It was powerful testimony. One complication was that since they were married, Peggy could not testify against her husband. Another was that, as descriptive as Peggy's story was, parts of it didn't check out.
We've gone all those places where you said you burned the bloody clothes and found nothing.
Maybe we didn't burn the clothes. I don't remember.
It appeared the law had caught a prime suspect in the Phantom Killer case.
But had they? Our story will continue in a moment, after a brief message.
Now, the story continues. With the apprehension of U.L. Swinney, the Arkansas state troopers thought they might finally be able to close the case.
But had they caught the killer? First of all, U.L. himself clammed up in interrogations.
I don't know what you're talking about. I have nothing to say.
And his wife, Peggy, was recanting.
I misspoke earlier. I was nervous and rattled. What I told you wasn't true.
Sure, she changed her tune now, but at one point she confessed.
All along, people had been confessing to the crime. Max Tackett himself said,
over the course of this case, at least 9 people have confessed to me that they are the Phantom Killer.
If you're looking for confessions, how about the Los Angeles coma veteran?
The Los Angeles coma veteran?
On May 23rd, an ex-Army Air Force machine gunner told Los Angeles police he thought he might be the Phantom.
I've been in a coma, running from something. Maybe murder. I want to clear it up. If I didn't kill 5 people in Texarkana, I just want to settle down and be a stuntman in Hollywood. I'm happiest when I'm living in danger.
So either he was a serial killer who blacked out and forgot his murders, or he was just a crazed nut who wanted to be a Hollywood stuntman?
Well, it turns out his story didn't hold up.
And Hollywood gains another stuntman.
Then there was the Shreveport confession. A man in a bar said he was the Phantom Killer after a reporter promised him a 1/5 of whiskey to tell all.
I did it. I shot them folks.
When the sheriff's deputy got to Louisiana, he recognized the man as an alcoholic from Texarkana.
You know you didn't kill those people. What did you go and do this for?
Well, hell, I got a 1/5 of whiskey out of it.
You're not comparing U.L. Swinney to a drunk in a Shreveport bar.
No, you're right. But there were other suspects. On May 7th, Herbert Thomas was flagged down by a hitchhiker in Kilgore, Texas.
I need a ride to Henderson. My mom's real sick. I'll give you $5.
Yeah, hop on in.
When they neared Henderson, the man pulled out a pistol.
Keep driving, or I'll kill you just like those 5 people I killed in Texarkana. I ain't done killing neither.
When they got to Lufkin, Texas,
turn around and drive back to Kilgore. If you follow me, I swear to God I'll kill you. Give me back that $5. Heck, give me everything that's in your wallet. $3? That's all you have?
Sounds like a straight robbery. And would the real Phantom be bragging about killing so much?
They were casting a wide net.
No offense, but it seems like every 2-bit criminal within a couple 100 miles of Texarkana is being accused of being the Phantom. How about a connection to the case?
Well then, how about the black man who was brought in for questioning because his tire tracks were found on the road near Paul Martin's body?
The polygraph shows deception.
So they decided to hypnotize him.
I want you to relax completely. We're going to count to 100 by 3s.
3, 6, 9, 12.
And to prove that he was under hypnosis,
you're going to feel no pain.
The psychiatrist stuck a burning cigarette to his arm and got no reaction. Then he asked the relevant questions.
Did you kill Betty Jo Booker?
No.
Do you know who did?
No.
His story checked out. It turns out he failed the polygraph because he was hiding an affair he was having with a married woman.
Well, that just shows how desperate the police were. But it sounds like you're building up to a more logical suspect.
You know me too well. On November 5th, 1948, an 18-year-old freshman at the University of Arkansas was found dead in his bed. Henry Booker Tennyson had killed himself with cyanide. He left a note with a poem on how to open his lockbox.
We don't have time to figure that out. Let's just break into the lockbox. Another note.
In the lockbox note, which was typewritten, Tennyson said,
"To whom it may concern, this is my last word to you fine people, and you are fine. Why did I take my own life? Well, when you commit 2 double murders, you would too. Yes, I did kill Betty Jo Booker at Paul Martin in the city park that night. I killed Mr. Starks and tried to get Mrs. Starks. You wouldn't have guessed it, but I did it when Mother was either out or asleep, and no one saw me do it."
Could Tennyson have been the killer?
It seems unlikely. His brothers said he had no experience with guns.
He claimed later in his note that he disassembled the guns and threw them away after the crimes.
What about his friend, James Freeman, saying he was with Tennyson for the entire night that Virgil Starks died? They were in the house playing cards until midnight.
Unless Freeman was in on it, or covering.
Now you're just grasping at straws. And now it's time for us to solve this case. Obviously, I think the killer is UL Swinney. He stole the car on one of the nights in question. His utterances show consciousness of guilt, and his own wife said he did it.
All very convincing.
So, tell me why I'm wrong.
Actually, I like Swinney too.
Oh, so you agree with me?
No, I think you agree with me.
Check out our Twitter poll. Do you think UL Swinney is the phantom killer? Yes or no?
And if you say no, let us know who you think did it.
Because like all our cases, this one remains officially unsolved.
In fact, the Texas Department of Public Safety still calls the killings the number one unsolved murder case in Texas history.
Ironically, the town at the center of it all has embraced its dark history. In 1975, Texarkana native Charles Pierce wrote and directed a film about the Phantom Killer called The Town That Dreaded Sundown.
The only thing we really do know is that we've got a very strange person on our hands.
And every year since 2001, right before Halloween, that movie is played out in the town square.
It's become a tale to tell, a legend.
Just like the campfire story of the Hook Man.
A crazed maniac is loose in the woods.
What was once true horror and fear
has evolved over time to entertainment.
But there was a postscript. 5 months after the last attack, in October of 1946, two men were repairing a fence near Morris Lane.
JF, hold up. You gotta see this.
What is it?
You're not gonna believe this.
What is that? Broken down suitcase?
No. It's for a musical instrument. I bet anything it's Betty Joe Booker's saxophone case.
Yes, there in the bushes, not 140 feet from where Betty Joe's body was found, was the deteriorated leather case that held her now tarnished saxophone.
Which proves even the most thorough search can miss what's right there.
And that things lurking beneath the surface can jolt us back to a reality that was fading away.
It was also a cruel reminder that even as the story of the Phantom Killer slipped into legend, there were real victims involved.
A Navy veteran starting a life after the war.
A teenager just out of high school.
A boy on the verge of becoming a man.
A farmer who did not live to see himself and his wife grow old.
And a young girl who would no longer play the music she loved.
All because of a masked man with evil intentions on a lonely country road.
Don't forget to subscribe to Unsolved Murders, True Crime Stories on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or any other podcast directory.
Or through our website, parcast.com. That's parcast.com.
A new episode of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Stories comes out every other Tuesday. Let us know what you think and join the conversation on our Parcast Facebook page.
You can tweet us at Parcast Network. That's Parcast Network.
As always, we thank you for listening.
And if you enjoyed the podcast, tell your friends.
I'm Carter Roy.
And I'm Wendy McKenzie.
We'll see you next time.
If we live till next time. Unsolved Murders, True Crime Stories, was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It's produced by Ron and Max Cutler, digitally engineered by Ron Shapiro, and written by Stephen DeLillo. Unsolved Murders, True Crime Stories stars Carter Roy and Wendy McKenzie. The amazing cast of voice actors includes, by alphabetical order, Mike Capozzi, Z. Cruz, Janice Liebhart, Stephen Pinto, Gregory Polson, and Vanessa Richardson.